Hamas releases disturbing video it says is of Israeli hostages.
The video ends with pictures that are allegedly the dead bodies of both men. Israel's military said it was examining the footage.
Plus, Iraq is recalling its ambassador after Iranian airstrikes in Erbil.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards said in a statement that it had targeted a headquarters of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, in the Kurdish area of Iraq.
And later, Volodymyr Zelensky is in Davos. Kim Jong-un wants to change the constitution. And the U.S. Navy intercepts a boat carrying Iranian warheads to Yemen. But something goes wrong. We'll find out what happened. Today is Tuesday, January 16th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Tuesday, the U.S. military carried out a new airstrike in Yemen targeting anti-ship ballistic missiles in a Houthi-controlled part of the country, two U.S. officials told Reuters. It's the latest military action against the Iran-backed group over its targeting of Red Sea shipping. U.S. officials were speaking on the condition of anonymity. They said the strike on Tuesday targeted four anti-ship missiles. We'll have more on the situation in the Red Sea later in the show. Now, since the war between Israel and Hamas began on October 7th, Israel has maintained that one of its primary objectives is to bring home the hostages taken by Hamas. That became a little more urgent on Monday as Hamas released a video purporting to show the bodies of two of the hostages. Reuters' Rachel Faber has the story.
Hamas aired a new video showing what it said were the bodies of two Israeli hostages on Monday, a day after warning Israel they might be killed if it did not stop its bombardment of Gaza. In the video released on Monday, 26-year-old university student Noah Argamani is seemingly reading a script in front of a white wall. She says that fellow hostages Itai Sfirsky and Yossi Shirabi have been killed. The video ends with pictures that are allegedly the dead bodies of both men. Israel's military said it was examining the footage. Argamani said in the video that they were killed by Israeli strikes and she was injured. Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari identified one of the men as hostage Sfirsky and specified that he was not killed by Israeli fire. The building in which they were held was not a target and it was not attacked by our forces, he said. Hagari did not give the name or details of the other hostage per the family's request. Israel's campaign in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas assault, which Israel says left 1,200 dead, has turned much of the Palestinian territory into a wasteland. Health officials there say some 24,100 people had been killed and nearly 61,000 wounded.
That was Rachel Faber of Reuters reporting. Elsewhere in the Israel-Gaza conflict, we are seeing the global ramifications of the Houthis' strikes on international shipping in the Red Sea. Reuters' Julian Satterthwaite has more.
The crisis in the Red Sea looks set to deepen after Houthi militants said they had started targeting U.S. ships. A spokesman for the militant group said Monday they had already hit one such cargo vessel. That came after a U.S. military spokesman said earlier that a U.S.-owned freighter had been struck by a missile. No injuries or significant damage were reported. The Houthis have been targeting vessels in the region since November, focusing on ones they say have a connection to Israel. They say that's in solidarity with Palestinian Islamists Hamas over the conflict in Gaza. The Houthis say US and British ships have become legitimate targets following strikes on Yemen by the two countries last week. Now there are signs that the crisis is causing mounting trouble for shipping and all the firms that rely on it. On Monday, more oil tankers altered course or paused their journeys to avoid the region. That threatens to delay or disrupt crude shipments, though the impact on prices has so far been modest. On Tuesday, oil traded slightly lower, as traders balanced the Red Sea concerns against worries that weak global demand could sap prices. Some tankers carrying Qatari natural gas towards the Suez Canal also paused their journeys, though they appeared to be back on course by Tuesday. The impact on container shipping has been more marked, with many vessels moved to safer but much longer routes. Car makers Tesla, Suzuki and Volvo have already warned that they will have to curb some output as a result, due to parts not arriving in time.
Julian Satterthwaite of Reuters reporting. And in a related story, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has confirmed that Canberra is supporting the United States and British airstrikes against Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has the story.
Australia's support for the raids against Houthi targets included defence personnel in what authorities have said were non-operational roles. Their precise duties weren't disclosed. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the Canberra government is part of a multinational effort to prevent Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping.
We have sent the help that is required. We have operational support there at headquarters in Bahrain. We always give proper and considered analysis and act in Australia's national interest. And that's been the basis of our support up to this point.
Australian Greens defence spokesperson David Shoebridge told local media that it was hypocritical of the US and Australian governments to launch airstrikes on Houthi positions in Yemen while claiming they wanted to avoid the conflict in Gaza spreading. This week, Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong makes an official visit to the region. She'll meet with the families of Israeli hostages, as well as the victims of Israeli settler violence in the occupied West Bank. Australia has said Israel has the right to defend itself after the attack by Hamas militants. Politically, Canberra is committed to a two-state solution, in which Israel and a future Palestinian state coexist within internationally recognised borders. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Meanwhile, near the Red Sea, it's been revealed that two U.S. Navy SEALs, the elite special operations soldiers, have been lost at sea. This occurred off the coast of Somalia as the Navy was intercepting and boarding a small boat carrying Iranian-made weapons, including missile warheads, to Yemen. For more, I'm joined by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
As the Navy SEALs were boarding this dhow off the coast of Somalia, there were massive swells. I mean, it was bad. It was late at night. 8-foot swells is what I'm hearing. And one of the Navy SEALs fell overboard as they were trying to board the dhow. And then, as is protocol for the Navy SEALs, you know, your partner goes in after you. So another SEAL jumped in to try to save him. They are still both missing at this point. And then the mission continued, and there were about 14 people on board this dhow. They were seized, and they are still in U.S. custody. They seized a lot of weapons components. There were rocket motors, anti-ship cruise missiles, turbojet engines used in these missiles, all of the equipment that these Houthis have been using in these dozens of attacks against vessels in the international waterways of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. So the U.S. military is saying that this was a very necessary raid and that it will help continue to prevent the Houthis from trying to strike, because that's what the U.S. military says it's trying to do.
You had said they were trying to board the dhow. That's the kind of boat. This is a small sailboat that's common off the coast of Africa and the Middle East.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, we know this happened somewhat off the coast of Somalia. Do we know where the boat originated?
They have not said that. That may come out in the next few days, and that may be part of the intelligence that they used to determine that this ship was carrying Iranian-backed weaponry bound for Yemen.
And what do we know about the people captured? Where are they from? Are they affiliated with the Houthis? Are they Iranians? What do we know?
We do not know the details at this point. They just released the details of the raid today. This raid actually happened several days ago on Thursday, around the same time that the U.S. was preparing to launch counterattacks into Yemen, those several dozen counterattacks that hit multiple locations inside Yemen. And the U.S. military is still saying that that is very successful. They were trying to deal with the fallout of that as well. They say that they were able to hit dozens of targets, including drones, drone launch sites, cruise missile, ballistic missile storage facilities and launch sites, radar sites, all the things that these Houthis need to continue these attacks against ships in international waterways.
Well, we'll stay tuned for more details. Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Carla, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is in Davos, Switzerland. We'll get an update in just a moment. First, though, Iran says it fired missiles at what it claims were Israeli spy headquarters near the consulate in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil and targets in northern Syria. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Islamic Republic of Iran news network footage shows missiles being launched in western Iran. 4 civilians were killed and 6 injured late Monday after missiles hit an upscale area near the consulate in Erbil, the seat of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdish region. Iran's Revolutionary Guards said in a statement that it had targeted a headquarters of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, in the Kurdish area of Iraq. Another statement said it had fired a number of ballistic missiles at terrorist operations, it called, including Islamic State targets in Syria, and destroyed them. The U.S. State Department has condemned the strikes as reckless. Iraq has recalled its ambassador and is summoning Iran's charge d'affaires. The foreign ministry has ordered its ambassador out of Iran for consultations and summoned Tehran's charge d'affaires in protest over Iranian strikes on northern Iraq that killed several civilians. The ministry says the Iranian attack was a blatant violation of Iraq's sovereignty, violates international law, and threatens regional security. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
President Zelensky is in Davos as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine was visiting the front lines. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the latest from Kyiv.
The president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, met with United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan during his visit to Davos, Switzerland, Zelensky confirmed on X, formerly Twitter. According to Zelensky, he thanked the U.S., President Joe Biden, Congress, and the American people for their unwavering support and leadership in supporting Ukraine, and noted that Ukraine is counting on the continued support of the U.S., which he says is extremely important. He noted that he informed Blinken and Sullivan about the current situation at the front line, the key tasks facing the armed forces of Ukraine for this year, and what is needed for them to be successful. Zelensky also said they discussed further cooperation between Ukraine and the U.S., with a special emphasis on air defense and long-range weapons. Zelensky also delivered a speech at the Davos World Economic Forum. He was talking about global threats caused by Russia, the Russian war in Ukraine, and the future of Ukraine and the world in the current circumstances. Zelensky said, "If anyone thinks this is only about Ukraine, they are fundamentally mistaken. Possible directions and even timeline of new Russian aggression beyond Ukraine become more and more obvious." He also said that Ukraine must gain air superiority just as it has gained superiority at the Black Sea. Talking about sanctions, he mentioned that sanction steps were delayed for months, even years, because they faced storms of threats from Moscow. But none of those threats came true. Each storm turned out to be their bluff. Meanwhile, over the weekend, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine, Valery Zaluzhny, reported several days of working meetings with the military on the front lines together with the chief of the general staff, Sergei Shaptala. He confirmed that he met with the commanders fighting in Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions. Elsewhere, late on Tuesday, the Ministry of Defense of Russia reported that the Voronezh and Belgorod regions of the Russian Federation came under attack by drones. Russian officials say that all drones were shot down or intercepted. According to the reports from the locals in Voronezh, a series of explosions were heard in the city. The governor of the region said no victims were reported. After the explosions, a state of emergency was introduced in the city. Ukrainian officials did not comment on the incident. VOA cannot verify this information independently. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Staying with the crisis, since Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, observers say Moscow has significantly stepped up the spread of fake news about Ukraine. Gnisia Turkova looks at what topics Russia has focused on and some of its most unusual claims.
This is some of the fake news that observers say Russia has published about Ukraine. Kyiv is sending kids to fight. Ukraine has made bulletproof vests for pregnant women. Ukrainian refugees give birth to kids in Swiss bunkers and then sell them. Concentration camp was established near Odessa for those who don't want to fight against Russia. These are actual headlines from Russian media outlets, according to a Ukrainian fact-checking website called Stop Fake. Co-founder Yevhen Fetchenko says even the most outlandish fake news should be debunked even as false information pours in.
Their main goal is to publish as many fakes as possible and bomb their audience with these fakes from all platforms, not giving it a chance to take a breath and see what's actually happening. The goal is to saturate the media landscape with fakes.
In 2023, Fetchenko says Russia's fake news centered on the front lines and Western aid to Ukraine.
Some were made to undermine the West's trust in Ukraine. This was the largest category. It's clear that it aligns with Russia's political and military goals to undermine any trust in Ukraine and to stop providing it with any sort of aid.
Fetchenko says Moscow has also pumped out countless articles falsely claiming that the West is sending Ukraine broken machinery, that Ukrainians do not know how to use it, and that Russia is managing to destroy it successfully.
We've seen headlines about Russia destroying the first F-16, even though previously Russia published pieces saying Ukrainians didn't know how to fly the F-16s. And even if they did, it would change nothing. And then, boom, news about how Russia has destroyed them, even before they made it to Ukraine.
Russia used AI to help produce its fake news last year. Fetchenko cites two deepfake videos spread by Russia, one that attempts to depict the head of Ukraine's armed forces allegedly calling for a coup, and another showing a conversation between President Zelensky and his wife. None of this was true.
This deepfake showed us that AI was able to analyze and recreate Zelensky's speech pretty well, but failed to do so with Zelensky's wife, because she didn't make as many speeches. So as a result, we see Zelensky speak Russian for some reason, and his wife responding to him in a weird Ukrainian dialect. None of this worked, of course.
Fetchenko says he and his team are doing all they can to counter Russia's flood of propaganda, but it's impossible to catch it all. Ksenia Turkova, VOA News.
Washington is stepping up its efforts to enforce sanctions against Russia, with secondary sanctions meant to stop Turkey from helping Moscow and its trading partners circumvent restrictions over the war in Ukraine. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, analysts say the success or failure of the sanctions will depend on how much nations stand to lose by restricting commercial links with Russia.
The Grande Italia is a regular visitor to Turkish ports, delivering Italian cars. As with several European countries, bilateral trade between Italy and Turkey has surged since the onset of the war in Ukraine, with a corresponding increase in Russian-Turkish trade. Turkey has been a conduit to circumvent sanctions, with Ankara saying it's not bound by the restrictions. Russia energy market specialist Tatiana Matrova is a visiting professor at the Paris School of International Affairs.
Turkey, which is still a significant off-taker of Russian gas and which is an important destination for Russian crude and petroleum products, which is frankly, a gateway for many financial transactions, supplies of equipment and everything else to Russia.
Many of Russia's neighbors have also recorded similar surges in bilateral trade with European countries since the imposition of sanctions against Russia. Mustafa Aydın of the International Relations Council of Turkey explains why some nations have in effect ignored efforts to pressure Russia.
It's about international interest. The countries who themselves might buy Russian oil products, but they also can criticize the countries who are becoming conduit for that trade and keep accusing Turkey of sanction evasion. So I can understand that this is the reality and it happens. So in that case, the question is whether these countries, the Europe and the United States, will go for a tightening of sanctions.
Last month, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order approving secondary sanctions that target financial institutions doing business with Russia. The measure may hurt a Turkish economy that's already suffering. Ankara says the sanctions are failing. Mesut Jarshan is a presidential advisor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
Russia is beneficial in this situation. Why? Russia is giving oil and gas to India, China, even though many European allies.
Turkey's leadership believes its refusal to enforce sanctions also allows it to play a mediating role between Russia and Ukraine. But analysts say Ankara is also relying on the hope that its Western allies will put their economic interests first and thus vote against more new sanctions. That's the assessment of Mustafa Aydın of the International Relations Council of Turkey.
If they do this, they will not only hurt Turkey or other countries, they will hurt themselves and their economies, so they are avoiding to do this.
For now, there are no signs of a slowdown at Turkey's busy ports and waterways, as trade continues to boom between Europe and Turkey, and Turkey and Russia, despite international efforts to tighten the economic noose on Moscow. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
And finally today, Kim Jong-un is pushing for a change in North Korea's constitution. Leila Shagroshaki of Reuters has the details.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has called for his country's constitution to be changed so that South Korea is seen as its primary foe and invariable principal enemy. The North State TV broadcast photos of Kim at the meeting where he warned the North would not avoid war should it happen. Kim also added that South Koreans should no longer be referred to as fellow countrymen. The South's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, hit back at the North hours later.
North Korean authorities defined South and North Korea as two hostile countries, not same-race countries. This shows the North Korean regime acknowledging their nature as anti-national and ahistorical.
In his speech to North Korea's rubber-stamp parliament, the Supreme People's Assembly, Kim added unification with the South was no longer an option. The North State TV also quoted him saying three organizations in charge of unification and inter-Korean tourism would be shut down. Kim's call for constitutional changes come as tensions have recently worsened in the Korean peninsula. There's been a series of missile tests and a push by Pyongyang to break with decades of policy and change how it relates to the South.
That's Reuters' Leila Shakroshaki reporting. All of this is happening as North Korea's foreign minister lauded deepening ties with Russia on Tuesday ahead of a rare meeting in Moscow with Russian President Vladimir Putin, whom Kim Jong-un has invited to North Korea. Putin has deepened ties with North Korea since the 2022 invasion of Ukraine, and the United States and its allies have condemned what they say have been significant North Korean missile deliveries to Russia to help in the war effort. And that's going to end today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.